Support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and gardening supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and 907-235-8777. Additional support comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In downtown Homer and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. As I am recording this, the Kenai Peninsula and most of Alaska is on a red flag warning for a fire, which means that we have very warm temperatures, low humidity, and strong winds. So I wanted to learn more about forests. Our guests today are Mitch Michaud and John Winters. Both of them are retired foresters. Mitch Michaud talks about a new reforestation program on the Kenai Peninsula. And Jonathan Winters talks about forest stewardship and protecting your forests from the threats of fire and insect infestations. Let's get started.
My name is Mitch Michaud, and I live in Soldotna, Alaska, and I am a registered professional forester. I've got accredited through the Society of American Foresters, and I've been working in Alaska for almost 25 years now, and probably another 20 years previous to that in the Northeast.
So I heard that you are developing a program for reforestation.
Yes, we are. This is through the Cook Inlet Keeper Drawdown Program. We made like number 4 on their list when they conducted these drawdown sessions. We rose to the top after we watched a lot of solar panels get put in, a composting situation, a program started, and then now we're into reforestation, which was really good because it gave us a chance for the past 2 years to think about what we would need for reforestation, and we were able to hone it down. We had a couple of meetings, we had some public sessions, and we realized that yes, we are losing trees. Yes, planting trees is an answer. The question is, who plants the trees? Where do you get them from? And where do you put them in the ground? The program is focusing predominantly on private landowners. There's a lot of government programs out there that are providing grant monies and financial assistance to organizations, cities, municipalities, etc. But small landowners, small being, you know, owning only a couple acres, really are left to their own. And anywhere else in the country, you would think small property owners can be able to go find trees. And it's much more difficult here in Alaska because we don't have as many options. So we're focusing on how can we get all those backyard trees that have disappeared to get growing again. But then we're also going to be dealing with the community trees and some of these green spaces that are being cleared out for fire mitigation and for safety. The drawdown is community directed, and if you can get community consensus, then you can get community buy-in, and then great things happen. So our priorities were solarize the Central Peninsula and composting.
Were you the champion for this topic?
At first, I was a naysayer of all things because this was right after the big burn that they had in the refuge a few years ago. And the public wanted to, let's go and reforest this burn. A lot of problems with that. It's on a national wildlife refuge. And fire is a natural part of the forest succession that we have here. So to go and try to recapture carbon by replanting the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge is kind of misguided and probably not really achievable. Well, it could be if you had enough money, but we have a lot better things to do with our funding, I guess. So I was actually against it. And then talking with people, then it became clear that people wanted to plant trees. So then we were able to focus and get to a point where everybody says, yeah, we should all go out and plant.
So I've been following this a little bit with what has been going on within the borough lately, but I'm wondering if you could kind of give an idea of what the conversation is within the borough.
You're referring to the borough timber harvesting and fuels mitigation project?
Yeah, I'm a little confused about it, I guess.
Well, the borough program is addressing borough parcels, and it's to essentially remove the standing dead trees and in some way, shape, or manner actually recover the cost of the removal through standing timber, a dead timber sale. And this is similar to what was done about 20 years ago, where there was a lot of borough properties that were salvage logged, and they recouped the income from selling them down to, not really for saw logs, because the borough was the late newcomer to the sales, but it got shipped and got sent over to the pulp mills on the west side of the right Pacific Rim. So, but the borough also had a reforestation program, and they went and got some reforestation dollars from the spruce bark beetle funding that occurred and did a lot of tree planting, and they augmented the tree planting with their timber sale revenues. So borough lands were actually reforested as a result of their past timber harvest, salvage harvest.
So then this is still kind of up in the air?
I've been following it. Actually, I talked to the land manager and Dakota Truitt, and his land manager is Marcus Mueller. We've been talking about it. And I bring up the topic of reforestation, and it says, yes, we have a grant for that. Yes, we're looking for some funding for that. But they're taking it in phases, and so they're essentially addressing the immediate need, which is reduction of the standing fuel load, and also to make some use and monetize some of the resources that's on borough land. And then I think their plan is, from what I gather from here in the borough meetings, is then they're going to be looking at what type of land uses will be occurring. I don't think they're going to classify the land, but I think it's a step forward in discussing what are we going to use these borough lands for now that we've cleared all of the dead trees on them. They're coming in to this program a little bit differently than they did in the past, with an intent on a future use. Not that it's been decided, that's a whole other project.
So their project, I think that I remember Dakota giving a presentation about looking forward and reforesting after the borough project was done. I'm wondering if the project that you're working with, Drawdown, you know, you had said it was for private landowners. Is there an overlap between the two projects?
There could be an overlap, and the overlap would be in purchasing. There's definitely an advantage when you're purchasing tree seedlings that you're not just purchasing 5 trees or 20 trees or 100 trees or even 1,000 trees. You need to be up like about 2,000 to 5,000. And if you really want to talk about the economies of scale, you're looking at 10 or 15 or 100,000 trees. And that's where, and I'm talking about small seedlings too, by the way. They're, you know, from 6 to 8 inches, you know, get above 10 or 12, they're getting a little too big for handling and shipping. So that's where the landowner kind of comes in on the short end, because they can't just buy a 6-inch tree at the local box store. There's a lot of organizations like 4-H and Society of American Foresters up in Anchorage. They do a tree sale, and I think maybe some garden clubs are doing this also. But essentially, they're buying in even smaller lots, and they're paying a lot for these trees when you get them shipped up here. So I've worked on reforestation on Kodiak and Frognerk Islands, and the native corporations were buying trees, you know, like 500,000 trees a year. And agglomerately, you know, all the corporations were sometimes putting in 1 million trees a year. Well, at that point, the price point for those trees is under 50 cents a tree. So, you know, it would be wonderful if I could get every landowner in the Central Peninsula, that if I could get trees at 50 cents a piece, another 25 cents to deliver them, that's 75 cents a tree. Then a homeowner could say, I'd like to have 20 trees to replace the 10 that I had chopped down. Then it becomes affordable, and then it becomes a pretty wide scope. We could put in 25,000. We could put in 50,000 trees in a community if we all just kind of did this and took advantage of economies of scales and organizations and people's excitement about planting trees, etc. And when you're looking at getting community to plant 25,000 trees, then yeah, that's great for the retailers, but we get a lot more trees planted if they're affordable.
What species of trees are these?
That's a really good question. And it really, really is, because I don't use that statement too often. Everybody has an idea of what trees they would like to have. And I have heard them, and I've gotten to be very, very kind in answering, because, you know, I had somebody telling me they wanted to plant sugar maple trees. And I said, well, they grow here. You can go up in Anchorage and you can buy them there. It says, yes, you can, but they're not really acclimated to here. And yes, there are temperatures in the lower 48 are comparable to what we have here on the Kenai Peninsula, but trees are acclimated not just for temperature, but about half of the trees that we all know about are acclimated to day length. If you take a birch tree that is from southern Michigan, you know, Ohio, and you bring that white birch tree and you bring it here to the Kenai, this tree will not do that well, because its phenology is a fancy word for the life processes that a tree goes through. When it breaks bud, when it goes dormant, is based on day length, and not the length of the day, but the rapid change in daylight. So what you find happening, and for all the people that are birch syrup tappers and making birch syrup, that typically birch always flow sap on the same week. They're like moose. They calve at the same time. And birch, there might be 4 feet of snow on the ground, and those birch trees are putting out sap. So some of the trees, about half of them, are triggered by day length. But our local spruce are pre-programmed. You know, the buds break on these as soon as the day length hits a certain time. It's usually about the same time the spruce bark beetle are kind of erupting too. But you'll see right now, I'm looking out my window and I'm getting really nice little buds. They still have the little bud scale on it, the little brown wrapper that the bud comes out. And this always happens at the same time. It coincides with our last frost. Typically our last frost day is coming up here on right Memorial Day. And we can talk a little bit more about how that last frost day enables us to plant other trees also. There's a couple of maples that people are planting now. There's some beautiful ones in Seldovia. There's a Crimson King red maple, which isn't really a red maple, but it's a variety of Norway maple. And that does fairly well. And I think if somebody was going to plant some maples here, those would be one that would probably do well, because it's Norway maple, Northern Europe. Those are things that people could start looking at. And then there's that other issue with anything that looks really, really good, and that's the moose, right, predation. But if you got them in your backyard, they're worth saving, protecting.
I mean, with some of these trees, you know, in Homer, there's a Mayday and chokecherry project to eradicate some of these trees. When you're selecting these species for reforestation, was there any data or consideration about the effects of the introduction of other species?
There's not a lot of data on exotics that were introduced to Alaska when it comes to trees. There's a lot of fear, and the fear comes from a valid concern, I would say. The one that grows really well here, which is an exotic, is European mountain ash. And then we have locally American mountain ash, and those are the ones that have the compound leaves with all the little leaflets, and they put out a wonderful white flower, and there's some berries that come off of them. A very nice, right, ornamental. Grows wild. It would grow in Homer, in the Homer area. It grows in south central Alaska, and it's very prominent up in the Seward area. The difference is that the European one has like 14 to 16 leaflets, and the American has 10 to 12. So the European is what we tend to find in the nurseries, because they're a nice fuller leaf. There's a concern is that they will hybridize, and we will essentially lose our American mountain ash here. Is it going to be the end of Mountain Ash? Probably not, but it does kind of pollutes our gene pool. The other one, the bird cherry, is valid, and that is showing up everywhere. I know some folks at the Kenai Watershed Forum. They keep me informed of where they're finding them. When I worked for the U.S. Forest Service, we were finding bird cherry May Day on old mining claims. You go up in the Chugat Mountains, and occasionally on those mining claims, you will find, because somebody brought some seed there and brought them in. So that's a whole different show, by the way. We could talk about how those are endangering. But I tell folks is that they have been known for causing moose deaths when moose are starving and they decide to eat the branches. There's a potassium cyanide compound that's in the twigs. And when you smell the twig, it smells of bitter almond. And if anybody's a Sherlock Holmes fans, they'll say, oh, Watson, he was poisoned because there was a smell of bitter almond in the goblet. So invasives are important. I'll go out and confess one of my sins. Maybe it's the one I committed or the one that I have yet to commit or I am committing now, is the introduction of lodgepole pine. And lodgepole pine does very well on the Kenai Peninsula. It's got a problem with moose. Bull moose during the rut like to use the Scotch pine as a rub. Maybe they like the cologne of pine pitch on their antlers to attract the cows. And at first, when I got here 20 some odd years ago, you know, we don't need to introduce this. And now with the advent of much warmer springs, with a fire return interval that's becoming more and more, that's getting smaller, lodgepole pine might be a good replacement for somebody who would like to grow something other than spruce. And the rationale for that is it's called the concept of assisted migration. If you go on the same latitude we are and we go due east, you'll run into Canada eventually. And once you get into the other side of the Canadian Rockies, or this side too, you start seeing lodgepole pine growing. And if you get up to Tok in Alaska, you'll see natural lodgepole pine that is slowly creeping into Alaska. And we have natural stands of lodgepole pine now. That's because it's a fire species. If fire comes in and wipes out all the native vegetation, its seed just moves further and further west. And eventually, if we keep burning things here, you'll see lodgepole pine entering the middle of Alaska on lands that were probably once covered in spruce. We'll still have spruce, we'll still have black spruce, but now we'll have lodgepole pine. I'm not putting all my money on assisted migration, but I think it's more of a viable option now.
Assisted migration means that humans are introducing this. This isn't something that is like a natural process of the succession of after a fire, then this other plant is coming in because of warming temperatures or something.
Right, correct. And the idea that you would assist is because the idea is that the ecotones or the ecological sites are changing faster than the species are able to occupy it. So think of it as everything on the Kenai Peninsula wasn't here at one time. Sitka spruce that's across the bay, Seldovia, is actually creeping into Homer. And there's some really nice Sitka spruce that are growing in Homer. And as we come up into the Kenai Peninsula or further eastern on the Kenai Peninsula, you see that it's hybridizing, and that's where you run into Lutz spruce. And then when you get to Anchorage, it turns back to mostly white spruce. But we'll see this change was probably occurring naturally. And now when we're getting warmer summers and more spruce bark beetle, we're probably going to see white spruce maintaining itself, since it's more tolerant of drought conditions than the Sitka spruce or the hybrid is. So it's moving really fast, but at a tree's pace. One of the things, I think on the Kenai Peninsula, you can't talk about trees without talking about climate change. And I think that's kind of the elephant in the room. So climate change is something that it's occurring here, and it shows up in our tree record. And anything we do from forest management, I think we need to keep an eye on this elephant. With all these successive fires, you know, we're on a red flag warning right now. It's not even Memorial Day, and we've been in it since like last weekend. having an increase in fire and increase in intensity, that is just unknown to what's going on the Kenai Peninsula. And there was a fellow named Bob Purcell, who was the former Homer fire chief. And I was at a meeting when I first got here, and he had a whole bunch of us foresters looking at the spruce bark beetle. And Bob took a box of matches out and lit a match. And he said, "How many of you are really nervous now?" And of course, the backdrop is he's standing chest deep in old, dried out Calamagrassa's Canada blue joint grass. And he said, "You should be." And he said, "Well, let me blow this match out because I'm getting worried too." He blows it out, and then we walk into a spruce forest, and he lights another match, and he said, "How many of you are nervous now?" And everybody chuckled because, and he said, "I'll just drop this match." And he drops it on the ground, and then he said, "Nope, nothing's happening." So he just stopped it and ground it into the ground. And he said, "The grass is going to be something that's going to be a problem here." And he says, "I'm looking at it from a fire standpoint." Most of his career, he was a firefighter in California. He predicted 20 years ago that grass is going to be influencing how fire behavior occurs on the Kenai Peninsula. He was right. All the fires that we've had here have been operating under conditions and following models that haven't even been developed yet. All the firefighters through the Alaska Fire Service love to go back after a fire is done and see how it fits a pre-existing knowledge. And they're having to rewrite the fire models now. And it's all based on grass. Well, now we're even having newer things, like the big burn we had in the refuge. That wasn't caused by spruce bark beetle. Most of that was all ground fuels. And, you know, there was no moisture for like 12 to 16 inches in the ground. There was no moisture. It was like sifting your hands through flour. So essentially the fire was driven by the understory. So, you know, that's a fire that's really difficult to put out and takes essentially had to burn itself out over the wintertime. So we have fire, and fire is going to change how we look at things. You know, fire doesn't kill everything, and the beetles don't kill every tree. But if you have successive beetle attacks, it used to be every 30 or 40 years, the beetle would come by every 130, depending on the cycles. Now it's on a 10-year cycle almost. Eventually, they're going to run out of trees to infect, but they're always going to be there. Now put in a fire return that occurs instead of every 300 years, it returns every 100 years. Now, a tree that survived the beetle and survived a fire, maybe the second fire in its lifespan takes it out. So now we're losing our seed source. So essentially, we might look at the Kenai Peninsula becoming not a grassland savanna, because that's been said before. But you're going to look at wide areas which are going to become non-forested and which will essentially support shrubs and grass waiting for the next fire to occur. And we'll still have our spruce and our little islands in the river corridors, but we're going to change the whole landscape. And this is actually supported by some modeling that a lot of government agencies have actually done. And luckily for everybody in Homer, the models, which this is a PRISM study that was done by three different agencies, Fish and Wildlife Service, USGS, and I think NOAA. And they modeled fire behavior, they modeled vegetation transitions, and also wildlife. And one of the things, which go back to Homer will probably not change much because it's such a maritime environment. There's always going to be moisture. You won't see those large grasslands occurring because there's always enough moisture to grow spruce. You get into the Nanilchik Highlands, you get up into Soldotna, Kenai area, you'll see this shifting to a shrub and grass. And that's kind of a predicted thing that's going to occur. And the question I always pose is, can we fix this? Because foresters, we're not wildland managers. We say, what can we do? And you can plant trees. Because if you can get enough trees to grow, you will have enclaves and you will be able to maintain forests. I'd like to tell everybody the National Arbor Day Foundation is in Lincoln, Nebraska, which is not an area that's noted for its forestry. But if you go to Lincoln, they do have a forest there. And it's one that's being maintained. It was actually established by just planting trees. So if you can landscape the Great Plains, you can probably forest landscape the Kenai Peninsula. You can tell I'm pitching tree planting, by the way. So
I did have some questions while you were talking. So in Homer, there's an old homesteader who talks about the terminal leaders on spruce trees and how the terminal leaders are getting larger or longer every year. And then I guess I'm wondering, you know, you were talking about climate change. Are there any indicators on the trees?
Yep, the terminal is good. The observation is correct. The leader growth on trees has been increasing, and that's because it's getting warmer. But what also happens when it gets warmer is that the tree, and in Homer, coastal areas, you have ample moisture. You get into the interior of Alaska, you're having heat stress on birch trees. Birch trees need a little more moisture than spruce does because they have leaves and leaves respire more. There's more moisture loss. So what happens when you have greater respiration for your spruce trees is that the trees are actually growing faster. And because they're growing faster, they're needing more water and they need more nutrients from the soil. So now the number of trees you have per acre will actually decrease. And that's what you see when you travel from Pacific Coast into the, not the Great Plains, but you get into the Rockies. When you get further away from that maritime influence, you have trees that are growing really fast, but you get to have fewer trees per acre. And that's kind of what the scenario is. And in the extreme is you'll go into sub-Saharan Africa, and naturally you're going to have an acacia tree, and then you're going to have 1,000 feet away, you'll have another acacia tree. You'll see how that it's, you still have trees, but you don't have that same type of forest. One of the things that happens that's really hard on us here on trees is when you get to seed germination. Right now, birch seed has fallen, and it's not germinating right now, which is okay, because I have some in some pots, and they're not breaking. But if we have some early season droughts, and then the seedlings germinate later in the year, then they're have a more likely chance that they're not going to survive the upcoming winter because they haven't put on enough food and energy rate reserves to carry them over in the wintertime, and then they would come back. So those are the changes you're going to see. I like birches especially because they're very sensitive, and I see early season drought stress. And the relationship with drought stress also shows up with spruce bark beetle, that if a tree is under drought stress, it's more likely to die from a beetle infestation. We should all know now that if you have a favorite spruce tree in your yard and you want to save it from the beetles, the best thing you can do is actually water it and keep it moist, because then it has its natural ability to essentially pitch out a beetle when it's in there, or to just, you know, smother them when they're inside too.
So when you were talking about the reforestation project, you had talked about using the lodgepole pines, or that was one of the species, and then other spruce. Is birch not a tree that is desirable for reforestation purposes?
In my home, I plant maybe 10, 15 birch trees every year. But what I do is I start with a seed, and then I get them up to about 3 feet, and then I transplant them and I cage them. Because of moose. You'll find them all through the Kenai Peninsula. You'll see they're called exclosures versus enclosures. We don't want really not worried about the trees jumping out of this big fenced area, but we're really trying to limit the amount of things that come in, being mostly moose. We would have more of a birch component in our forest if it weren't for the moose. And example is you go to the old Swanson River burns up in the refuge where the moose pens are, where they do some research. And you see what happened when we had a fire in the 40s and there was very little moose in the area. And those are stands that are almost completely birch. But now if you have a similar situation with higher moose predation like you have down in the Southern Peninsula, because you don't have a lot of moose, but you get up in the Caribou Hills and you start looking at trying to find a tall birch tree, you won't find anything. The moose have been keeping it down. It's a wonderful species. It's not really short-lived. It'll live over 100 years. It's shade in the summer and lets sunlight in the winter. So it's my favorite tree.
So those are all my questions. Is there anything that you wanted to say or that I'm leaving out?
from a cultural thing, we live in a really turbulent time. There's always something going on. If it's not the Second World War, it's something else. And now we've got all these other factors. You can always plant a tree. I mean, there's very few things you can do as a person that will leave a legacy well beyond your own years. By the time the tree you plant today is going to become valued by the next person that hey, this is a gorgeous birch tree, they will have long forgotten who I was or who you were if you planted some spruce in your backyard. I tell people, if you want to leave a great legacy in tree planting, plant a row of trees. So whenever you're stressed and you feel you don't have any control of your own environment or in control of your own life, you can plant a tree, and you know that, you know, with a little bit of care, it'll be there forever. So that's Mitch's zen of tree planting.
And that was Mitch Michaud, recorded May 25th, 2022. Up next, we talk to newly retired forester John Winters about forest stewardship.
My name is John Winters. I work for the Alaska Division of Forestry as a forester. For the state, my job specifically is to help landowners with their forest, managing their forested property. It entails a broad range of topics. It could be fire protection, it could be insect and disease awareness, could be reforestation, perhaps trying to develop or maintain wildlife habitat, wood utilization, some broad topics.
How long have you been with forestry?
I began working for state forestry in 1990 and started the career in 1981.
So over 40 years.
And I'm retiring in 8 days.
You're retiring in 8 days. Tell me more about that. Are you excited?
Oh yeah. It's gonna be bittersweet because I've enjoyed this job tremendously and this line of work tremendously.
Do you have any plans?
I'll be remaining here on the Kenai Peninsula and certainly in Alaska and just doing more travel in Alaska and trying to see places that I haven't had a chance to visit in the summer in Alaska.
What's the top of the list?
Oh, I'd like to go back up to the Arctic coast. Maybe go back up to Barrow or go see Nome again.
That's where I want to go. I want to go to the Arctic.
And it's interesting to see it in the summertime.
But that's really interesting for someone that has devoted their life to trees. The first place that you want to go is someplace without trees.
I've also devoted myself to Alaska, so I look forward to any kind of opportunity that I can have to just see some of the treasures that we have in this place, in this state.
How did you first become interested in forestry?
Since I was a kid. I think what set me to wanting to be a forester was backpacking in the Colorado Rockies in about 1978 and being up there in the high mountains during a thunderstorm, watching lightning strike trees and start fires. And the next year I was going to forestry school. I came up to Alaska in 1985 to be on the Chena Hotshot crew. That was a wildland firefighting crew based out of Fairbanks.
When it comes to fires, have you noticed any trends?
Certainly over the last 10 years, there's been an increase in the intensity of fires on the Kenai Peninsula, case in point, Funny River, Card Street, Swan Lake. Those are large fires that have occurred. South Central Alaska in general, Mat-Su Valley in those similar years had large fires such as McKinley, Sockeye. So there's been a trend of large fires, difficult to control, requiring a lot of resources, and an increased call for people to make sure that they have defensible space around their homes.
How large is a defensible space?
Recommended defensible space, we start nearest the house and design the defensible space and the work to progress outward from the house. Recommend all burnable, fire-receptive vegetation, such as spruce trees, dead grass, tall grass, be removed from within 30 feet of a structure, and then continuing further from 30 feet on out to 100, thinning out spruce trees so they're not in dense groups, removing the lower 40% of the branches so that they don't have the branch whorls extending all the way to the ground. That makes them less prone to catching fire if the fires are spreading on the ground. Of course, removing all dead or infested trees, keeping grass cut or at least manicured down to less than 4 inches. And that's from 30 to 100 feet out. I actually encourage hardwood species, cottonwoods, birch, aspen, be retained because they're providing shade and aesthetic properties that people enjoy. But the shade being important is that it can keep grass, it can inhibit that tall blue joint reed grass from growing too close to houses. That spread of grass, it's very fire receptive. It produces pretty large, intense flames, and you want to have that a safe distance away from your structures. There is an important issue here going on with large acreage of trees being infested, dying, posing an eventual wildfire fuels problem, fuel loading, and then there'll be a need for some forest management to try to encourage regrowth of these forests that are dying off.
I had heard that you created this comprehensive self-study guide about forest stewardship.
The self-study guide was designed for people that have forested land to learn more about forests, learn more about tree species, learn more about planting, learn more about developing some habitat for birds, learn more about soils, where they happen to live. And it would provide that information. If they wanted to go a little bit further, the document could be used to create what's called a stewardship plan, or essentially a forest management plan for their property, where they would get an idea of prioritizing the tasks that they want to do for their property over, say, a 10-year time frame, decide which of those is the most important, identify what their forest management goals are. Do they want to have wildlife? Do they want to have species diversity and age diversity of tree species? Whatever their interests or concerns are, they could go through this, draft out a plan. If they want a site visit from the Division of Forestry, they can contact the Division of Forestry and let us know that they're interested in a site visit. We would come out there and do that. And if they wanted a finalized forest stewardship plan, we could use the information that they're providing in that self-study guide for producing a final forest stewardship plan.
So most of the people that you work with, they probably have huge acreage.
Not necessarily. Lately, i.e. the last 7 years or so, the average size property that I visit is probably going to be more like maybe 7 acres or 10 acres. Lots of small properties, just under 2 acres, but I'll still work with people if they have questions about dealing with bark beetles or fire protection.
So is that like a PDF on the computer?
Yes.
What is it called?
It's called the Self-Study Guide to Forestry. It's accessible by the Alaska Division of Forestry's website. That's www.forestry.alaska.gov/stewardship.
What is the work that takes place after a fire?
Basic planting practices. How do you plant trees? How do you transplant trees? What can be done in their future there to ensure that their place has defensible space from fire?
What are some of people's concerns?
Defensible space, fire protection, and insect and disease mitigation. So that's what's been the biggest concerns, and that's where I've got most of my calls from, and those have been the priority forestry goals for landowners. And it's actually come from a lot of the smaller acreage property owners.
You know, you talk about insects and disease mitigation, you know, and most people are pretty aware of spruce bark beetles, but are there other infestations or insects that pose a threat?
Well, in 2016, 2017, there were outbreaks of spruce aphids here along the waterfront here in Homer. Damaged, killed a fair number of trees. It was, compared to the spruce beetle epidemic, fairly short-lived, but it caused some mortality of trees and disfiguration and raised a lot of concerns for people.
You mentioned insects, but what else will affect a forest's health?
An ongoing condition with trees I've noticed, particularly on the Kenai Peninsula, in spruce, in birch trees, and in aspen, and it's probably present in cottonwoods, is just natural fungal infections that affect the core of the tree. And they could be a result, they could be from fungus that has come up through the roots or otherwise has grown through the tree, causing what's called commonly heart rot. And what it has done is it weakens a lot of the trees. And so it's possible for trees to, they wind snap, they fall over every year and they're pushed over by the wind. And people will notice when they're out driving around and they see these downed trees, they might have perfectly fresh looking green live limbs and foliage, but their trunk is crushed where it was blown over by the wind. And inside there's just so much rot in there, there was not really any structural integrity left in the tree. And that can be found in probably all the species of trees on the Kenai Peninsula. One of the things about this guide is people can read and learn about some of the external indicators, visual indicators that a tree might have internal rot going on. And it's of particular importance if you have a tree in close proximity to a house or power lines.
Because of the threat of the tree falling?
That'd be the most significant thing, yeah. Some people fear that as soon as trees die from spruce beetles, that they're going to immediately fall over. That may not always be the case. It really depends on if there's pre-existing rot in the core of the trees. The bark beetles had little of anything to do with that.
So I don't know if this is a result of the bark beetles, but a lot of times I notice with the spruce trees, what'll happen is they'll get really top heavy. A windstorm could easily blow them over. Is that a result of spruce beetles?
A very common condition of trees, forests on the Kenai are very densely populated, thick stands of trees growing close together and been doing so for a long time. And what it's resulted in are trees that are very top heavy, where there's not, if the trees are growing in a dense stand, the ones that are in those large groups of trees can hold their own against the wind. There will be on occasion some of them breaking over, but if they are opened up or isolated through thinning, once they're that old and tall, there is a high possibility that they can fall over or snap over in the wind.
So it's an adaptation of the tree towards the light?
Yes.
So if you have these areas where there is a large forest die-off, what happens as far as like the succession? Like what comes in after a forest dies?
Depends on the location. Like in the case here on the South Peninsula, it was often just dense grass that grew in and occupied the site and it became grassland. Other parts of the Kenai Peninsula, after fires or after a large die-off of beetles, the succession started with the brush species, willow, alder, and then succession continued with aspen, birch. Both of those species are pretty aggressive post-disturbance species that can come in and occupy an area pretty well. They have the ability to reproduce vegetatively through roots or through stump sprouting, and so they're able to reproduce pretty effectively. They establish then as a predominantly hardwood type of forest made up of those species, and then eventually young spruce are able to get some kind of a foothold in there and eventually come in. So that cycle of succession starts over again, possibly with the spruce someday being the climax species.
Is it different for a fire, the succession?
Depends on where the fire occurred, how intense the fire was, but those types of succession of species, brush, then the hardwood trees, that's pretty common because grass is a very, very successful competitor.
He talks about different tree species. Is there anything like really interesting or fascinating about trees that it's kind of like, wow, I don't know if a lot of people know this?
Probably all tree species have some kind of feature about them that is very interesting that people would not maybe know or understand. One example, aspen, quaken aspen, photosynthesis, it actually occurs through their bark. They can photosynthesize through their bark. So if a tree was burned or it lost its foliage, it might still have the ability to photosynthesize enough to where it could at least sprout young trees through their roots.
Wow. I wonder if that's an adaptation from adapting to fires specifically.
That type of reproduction for a tree provides two avenues, two means of reproduction, so that if seeds don't work because ground surface conditions aren't favorable, there's not enough seed beds for seed to receive seeds for germination, well, they can just do it off of their roots. Or if the ground has been badly burned or there's some condition going on that's not favorable to reproduction by roots, then they can do it through seeds. Another example is black spruce. Black spruce can produce trees from their lower limbs through a process called layering, where the lowest limbs on those trees become inundated with moss from being in the tundra and muskegs for a very long time. That vegetative mat starts to cover over a lower limb, a bottom limb on the tree, and that limb that's sticking out, the end of it that's sticking out, is able to start producing roots under it and it becomes its own tree. Black spruce is an example of a tree that can layer.
So, you know, we've been talking about just generally spruce, but yeah, there's all types of spruce. What kinds of spruce would you find here on the peninsula?
You would have black spruce, there's white spruce, there's Sitka spruce, and then there is a hybrid, a naturally occurring hybrid of Sitka spruce and white spruce called Lutt spruce.
What does it mean to have a resilient forest?
It's a forest that can sustain the impacts of infestation and fires. And key ways of attaining a resilient forest is diversity of species and diversity of ages within species.
So biodiversity, are you talking just about trees? Or are you talking about all vegetation?
I'm referring mostly, or I focus mostly on trees. And that's diversity of the tree species or diversity of the ages within tree species or both. Kenai Peninsula, a lot of properties, a lot of area around here is almost purely spruce forests. So there's more of a challenge to get birch, aspen, naturally occurring aspen is quite a ways away from here. There's an opportunity for cottonwoods, but if you can get mixes of these species here, then if there's fires or infestations, hopefully it'll only affect one of those species, but you'll still have essentially trees left. Absent the ability to have species diversity, then the next thing to look forward to is diversity of ages within the species that you have, because fires, aphids, bark beetles affect trees differently depending on their ages. Spruce beetles attack and kill mature spruce trees. They don't normally attack young trees. They don't have the young trees don't have the food, and they usually have too much vigor in order for a spruce beetle to be able to attack it. Spruce beetles do not attack seedlings. However, large trees, especially if they're pruned or conditioned, can withstand the impacts of a fire, especially if the fire is, you know, burning more on the surface, whereas small seedlings, smaller trees, are more likely to be destroyed. So again, if there's these mixes of ages, there's an opportunity to sustain these impacts that we have on forests. The spruce beetle's flight is typically from May, or maybe a little bit earlier, like late April, through July, when the temperatures are solidly in the 60s and holding. The beetles emerge and they're looking for new host trees. And one of the things that attracts bark beetles is freshly cut trees. That scent draws beetles in and can lead to swarms. And so to mitigate that problem, especially again in areas where there hasn't been, you know, infestations occurring, I encourage the defensible space work like thinning, pruning, any kind of cutting of spruce trees to be done after August. And August, September provides an opportunity. If people want firewood, they can cut spruce trees, cut them into stove-sized pieces, split them to, you know, promote drying as quickly as possible so that possibly those pieces could be burned before the next beetle emergence the next spring.
So if I'm hearing you right, you know, we're talking about green wood. So if you were harvesting your own firewood, you would want to harvest it ideally in the fall.
Ideally, you'd want to be doing it as soon as the spruce beetle flight is over with, and that's going to be likely the end of August. Some other forest practices that are recommended is to avoid stacking firewood, spruce firewood, against other spruce trees, because the bark beetles like to emerge in the springtime and get to the spruce trees as quickly as possible. And if that means crawling into another tree instead of flying, they will do it. Pruning spruce trees, in other words, removing those lower limbs on spruce trees, is best done in the fall and winter months. It's been said the months with R in them is kind of a rule of thumb, but the reason being is that those trees are dormant and they're not going to be as stressed by pruning as they would be if you're doing it in the spring and summertime when they're trying to grow. Homer, people that have forested land down here are going to need to be careful. They're going to need to be careful what they do with their firewood, because where are they getting firewood? They're getting that beetle kill. The beetle kill, if it's infested, they bring it down and they stack it up against their spruce trees in their yard, they can get that infestation started. That's part of this education. That's part of why I'm wanting to outreach Homer, you know, and let people know about proper forest practices and look online for ways of managing your firewood and checking your firewood for bark beetles.
You know, I didn't even think about that, how you could just be taking this infestation from one community to another.
So it's going to be very important for people to understand how to handle firewood, how to check firewood for bark beetles, how to avoid, best thing is to avoid getting infested firewood, and then proper storage. There's some things that people can do. They're labor intensive, but if you're really concerned about preventing bark beetles from being on your property and you've got a load of firewood, you can go check for indicators of bark beetles, like pitch tubes, holes in the trees, things like that, boring dust. If that's present, then cut into the tree, into the bark, peel it back with a log peeler, and see if there's beetles under there.
So yeah, when I peel back the bark and I look at it and it looks like little mazes. And
those are called galleries. And what they're doing is they're eating the cambium. They thrive on that inner bark of the tree and they're eating that cambium. And they're eating it and they're also creating caverns or what they call galleries, a space where they can breed their young. They can lay eggs and the young can develop into adults and then emerge in that springtime like I described and move on to the next host trees. And that larva and those live eggs can be present and overwinter in firewood pieces and then emerge the next spring on a property where people have stacked this firewood right next to their spruce trees on their property. And that can easily trigger an outbreak of spruce beetles. So it's very important for people living in the communities that have not gone through the infestation to understand that, so that they're not doing things that will attract bark beetles and trigger outbreaks.
Do the bark beetles eat anything else besides spruce?
They primarily attack white spruce, Sitka spruce, Lutz spruce, rarely attack black spruce, do not attack hemlock. They've been known to attack pines and rarely larches.
Do you know if anything eats them?
Woodpeckers, birds. That's where you see those craters in the side of a tree where there's been just big, huge divots of bark chipped out. Looks like somebody went in there and chipped it away. It's woodpeckers. So you look at that, then you look for what's called pitch tubes. They look like little globules of pitch. They're kind of thick, almost looks like brownish or amber-colored caulking.
On the side of the tree. I've seen those.
Yeah, that looks like a dried glue or pitch. It can be brownish. It could be almost dark brown, like chocolate brown. It can be amber colored. And then there's dust that looks like dried coffee grounds or dried snuff, mostly at the base of the trees. Sometimes you can see it in bark fissures. getting back to this, these pitch tubes, that substance is called frass. It's a mixture of the tree's natural pitch and that boring dust. The boring dust passes, the bugs pass that through them as they're eating through that cambial layer, and they exit it through the hole they came in at, and it gets mixed with that pitch and ejected out onto the, because it's thick and viscous, it usually sets up and hardens on the side of the tree in those little globs like that. That's a pitch tube. The only thing is you may not see those if it's been firewood that's been cut and loaded into a truck. They might get knocked off of there. So there's some external indicators of bark beetles. On the subject of fire, since we're now in the throes of it, it's starting up. One of the things is, when we talk about this seasonality of the defensible space work, people can still be doing it now this time of year, but the kind of things they'd be doing is gardening, mowing lawns, fertilizing, watering lawns, clearing away construction, building materials, storing flammable, inorganic materials in a manner that minimizes the chance of them catching fire as much as possible, because wildland firefighters responding don't have respiratory protection. And we need to provide a safe opportunity for them to do their jobs without unnecessary risks associated with toxic fumes. This is the time of the year for gardening, for cleaning up your yards, making sure that you've got your yard arch, your old 1960 snow machine picked up, fiberglass solvents put away, so that if you have a fire in your area, you're gonna reduce the chance of having a fire that produces toxic fumes.
And that was John Winters, recorded at the KBBI studio on May 19th, 2022. And that's the show. I want to thank guest Mitch Michaud and John Winters. I will have a link to John Winters' Forest Self-Study Guide with the post that accompanies this episode. And I have to say that it is amazing. It is 65 pages of pretty interesting information about forests. Just on page 10, I learned how to estimate the height of a tree using a stick. I also want to thank Homer Soil and Water Conservation District and co-producer Nicole Arevalo. Also, thank you to local musicians Kevin Cope and Ryan Black for providing the music for this show. I want to say thank you as well to the Alaska Center for Excellence in Journalism. This week I found out that I received a grant to do some reporting on agriculture in rural Alaska. So Homer Grown is traveling. There are a few places on the list, but if you know of underreported stories about agriculture in communities off the road system, let me know. People in places deserve a voice. Email Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer. Support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and gardening supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and 907-235-8777. Additional support comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. in downtown Homer, and on the web at wotabotanicals.com.